and threadbare wood. He walked out in the morning and took the river path downstream. The boy was right that it was a good place, and he wanted to check for any sign of other visitors. He found nothing. He stood watching the river where it swung, loping into a pool and curled and eddied. He dropped a white stone into the water, but it vanished as suddenly as if it had been eaten. He'd stood at such a river once and watched the flash of trout deep in a pool, invisible to see in the tea-colored water except as they turned on their sides to feed, reflecting back the sun deep in the darkness like a flash of knives in a cave. "We can't stay," he said. "It's getting colder every day, and the waterfall is an attraction. It was for us, and it will be for others. And we don't know who they'll be, and we can't hear them coming. It's not safe."
"We could stay one more day."
"It's not safe."
"Well, maybe we could find some other place on the river."
"We have to keep moving. We have to keep heading south."
"Doesn't the river go south?"
"No, it doesn't."
"Can I see it on the map?"
"Yes. Let me get it." The tattered oil company road map had once been taped together, but now it was just sorted into leaves and numbered with crayon in the corners for their assembly. He sorted through the limp pages and spread out those that answered to their location. "We cross a bridge here. It looks to be about 8 miles or so. This is the river going east. We follow the road here along the eastern slope of the mountains. These are our roads, the black lines on the map, the state roads."
"Why are they the state roads?"
"Because they used to belong to the states, what used to be called the states."
"But there's not any more states?"
"No."
"What happened to them?"
"I don't know exactly. That's a good question."
"But the roads are still there?"
"Yes, for a while."
"How long a while?"
"I don't know. Maybe quite a while. There's nothing to uproot them, so they should be okay for a while."
"But there won't be any cars or trucks on them?"
"No."
"Okay.
Are you ready?" The boy nodded. He wiped his nose on his sleeve and shouldered up his small pack, and the man folded away the map sections and rose, and the boy followed him out through the gray palings of the trees to the road. When the bridge came in sight below them, there was a tractor trailer jackknifed sideways across it and wedged into the buckled iron railings. It was raining again, and they stood there with the rain pattering softly on the tarp, peering out from under the blue gloom beneath the plastic.
"Can we get around it?" the boy said.
"I don't think so. We can probably get under it. We may have to unload the cart." The bridge spanned the river above a rapids. They could hear the noise of it as they came around the curve in the road. A wind was coming down the gorge, and they pulled in the corners of the tarp about them and pushed the cart out onto the bridge. They could see the river below them through the ironwork. Below the rapids was a railroad bridge laid on limestone piers. The stones of the piers were stained well above the river from the high water, and the shore of the river in the bend was choked with great windrows of black limbs and brush and the trunks of trees. The truck had been there for years, the tires flat and crumpled under the rims. The front of the tractor was jammed against the railing of the bridge, and the trailer had sheared forward off the top plate and jammed up against the back of the cab. The rear of the trailer had swung out and buckled the rail on the other side of the bridge and had hung several feet out over the river gorge. He pushed the cart up under the trailer, but the handle wouldn't clear. They'd have to slide it under sideways. He left it sitting in the rain with the tarp over it, and they duck-walked under the trailer, and he left the boy crouched there in the dry, while he climbed up on the gas tank step and wiped the water from the glass and peered inside the cab. He stepped back down and reached up and opened the door, and then climbed in and pulled the door shut behind him. He sat looking around. An old doghouse sleeper behind the seats, papers in the floor. The glove box was open, but it was empty. He climbed back between the seats,
There was a raw, damp mattress on the bunk and a small refrigerator with the door standing open. A fold-down table. Old magazines in the floor. He went through the plywood lockers overhead, but they were empty. There were drawers under the bunk, and he pulled them out and looked through the trash. He climbed forward into the cab again and sat in the driver's seat and looked out down the river through the slow, trickling water on the glass. The thin drum of rain on the metal roof and the slow darkness falling over everything. They slept that night in the truck, and in the morning the rain had stopped, and they unloaded the cart and passed everything under the truck to the other side and reloaded it. Down the bridge 100 feet or so were the blackened remains of tires that had been burned there. He stood looking at the trailer.
"What do you think's in there?" he said.
"I don't know."
"We're not the first ones here, so probably nothing."
"There's no way to get in."
He put his ear to the side of the trailer and whacked at the sheet metal with the flat of his hand. "It sounds empty," he said. "You can probably get in from the roof. Somebody would have cut a hole in the side of it by now."
"What would they cut it with?"
"They'd find something."
He took off his parka and laid it across the top of the cart and climbed onto the fender of the tractor and onto the hood and clambered up over the windscreen onto the roof of the cab. He stood and turned and looked down at the river, wet metal underfoot. He looked down at the boy. The boy looked worried. He stood and turned and reached and got a grip on the front of the trailer and slowly pulled himself up.
It was all he could do. And there was a lot less of him to pull.
He got one leg up over the edge and hung there, resting. Then he pulled himself up and rolled over and sat up. There was a skylight about a third of the way down the roof, and he made his way to it in a walking crouch. The cover was gone, and the inside of the trailer smelled of wet plywood and that sour smell he'd come to know. He had a magazine in his hip pocket, and he took it out and tore some pages from it and wadded them and got out his lighter and lit the papers and dropped them into the darkness. A faint whooshing. He wafted away the smoke and looked down into the trailer. The small fire burning in the floor seemed a long way down. He shielded the glare of it with his hand, and when he did, he could see almost to the rear of the box. Human bodies. Sprawled in every attitude, dried and shrunken in their rotted clothes. The small wad of burning paper drew down to a wisp of flame and then died out, leaving a faint pattern for just a moment in the incandescence, like the shape of a flower, a molten rose. Then it darkened to ash. They camped that night in the woods on a ridge overlooking the broad Piedmont plain where it stretched away to the south. He built a cook fire against a rock, and they ate the last of the morels and a can of spinach. In the night, a storm broke in the mountains above them and came cannonading down country, cracking and booming, and the stark gray world appeared again and again out of the night in the shrouded flare of the lightning. The boy clung to him. It all passed on, a brief rattle of hail, and then the slow, cold rain. When he woke again, it was still dark, but the rain had stopped, a smoky light out there in the valley. He rose and walked out along the ridge, a haze of fire that stretched for miles. He squatted and watched it. He could smell the smoke. He wet his finger and held it to the wind. When he rose and turned to go back, the tarp was lit from within where the boy had wakened. Sighted there in the darkness, the frail blue shape of it looked like the pitch of some last venture at the edge of the world. Something all but unaccountable. And so it was. All the day following, they traveled through the drifting haze of wood smoke. In the draws, the smoke coming off the ground like mist, and the thin black trees burning on the slopes like stands of heathen candles. Late in the day, they came to a place where the fire had crossed the road, and the macadam was still warm, and further on, it began to soften underfoot.
They stopped. "We'll have to wait," he said. They backtracked and camped in the actual road, and when they went on in the morning, the macadam had cooled. By and by, they came to a set of tracks, cooked into the tar. They just suddenly appeared. He squatted and studied them. Someone had come out of the woods in the night and continued down the melted roadway.
"Who is it?" said the boy.
"I don't know. Who's anybody?" They came upon him shuffling along the road before them, dragging one leg slightly and stopping from time to time to stand stooped and unmoving before setting out again.
"What should we do, Papa?"
"We're all right. Let's just follow and watch."
"Take a look," the boy said.
"Yes, take a look." They followed him a good ways, but at his pace they were losing the day, and finally he just sat in the road and didn't get up again. The boy hung on to his father's coat, and they went past. No one spoke. He was as burnt-looking as the country, his clothing scorched and black. One of his eyes was burnt shut, and his hair was but a nitty wig of ash upon his blackened skull. As they passed, he looked down, as if he'd done something wrong. His shoes were bound up with wire and coated with road tar, and he sat there in silence, bent over in his rags. The boy kept looking back.
"Papa," he whispered, "what's wrong with the man?"
"He's been struck by lightning."
"Can't we help him?" "Papa?"
"No, we can't help him." The boy kept pulling at his coat.
"Papa," he said,
"stop it."
"Can't we help him, Papa?"
"No, we can't help him. There's nothing to be done for him." They went on. The boy was crying. He kept looking back. When they got to the bottom of the hill, the man stopped and looked at the boy, and he looked back up the road. The burned man had fallen over, and at that distance, you couldn't even tell what it was.
"I'm sorry," he said, "but we have nothing to give him. We have no way to help him. I'm sorry for what happened to him, but we can't fix it. You know that, don't you?"
The boy stood looking down. He nodded his head. Then they went on, and they didn't look back again. At evening, a dull sulfur light from the fires, the standing water in the roadside ditches black with the runoff, the mountains shrouded away. They crossed a river by a concrete bridge where skeins of ash and slurry moved slowly in the current. Charred bits of wood. In the end, they stopped and turned back and camped under the bridge. He carried his billfold about till it wore a corner-shaped hole in his trousers. Then one day he sat by the roadside and took it out and went through the contents. Some money, credit cards, his driver's license, a picture of his wife. He spread everything out on the blacktop like gaming cards. He pitched the sweat-blackened piece of leather into the woods and sat holding the photograph. Then he laid it down in the road also, and then he stood and they went on. In the morning, he lay looking up at the clay nests of swallows in the corners under the bridge. He looked at the boy, but the boy had turned away and lay staring out at the river.
"There's nothing we could have done."
He didn't answer.
"He's going to die. We can't share what we have, or we'll die too."
"I know."
"So when are you going to talk to me again?"
"I'm talking now."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes."
"Okay."
"Okay."
They stood on the far shore of a river and called to him. Tattered gods slouching in their rags across the waste, trekking the dried floor of a mineral sea where it lay cracked and broken like a fallen plate. Paths of feral fire in the coagulate sands. The figures faded in the distance. He woke and lay in the dark.
The clocks stopped at 1:17. A long shear of light and then a series of low concussions. He got up and went to the window.
"What is it?"
she said. He didn't answer. He went into the bathroom and threw the light switch, but the power was already gone. A dull rose glow in the window glass. He dropped to one knee and raised the lever to stop the tub, and then turned on both taps as far as they would go. She was standing in the doorway in her nightwear, clutching the jamb, cradling her belly in one hand.
"What is it?" she said. "What's happening?"
"I don't know."
"Why are you taking a bath?"
"I'm not." Once in those early years, he'd wakened in a barren wood and lay listening to flocks of migratory birds overhead in that bitter dark. Their half-muted crankings, miles above where they circled the earth, as senselessly as insects trooping the rim of a bowl. He wished them Godspeed till they were gone. He never heard them again. He'd a deck of cards he found in a bureau drawer in a house, and the cards were worn and spindled, and the two of clubs was missing. But still, they played sometimes by firelight, wrapped in their blankets. He tried to remember the rules of childhood games, old maid, some version of whist. He was sure he had them mostly wrong, and he made up new games and gave them made-up names. Abnormal fescue, or cat barf. Sometimes the child would ask him questions about the world that for him wasn't even a memory. He thought hard how to answer. "There's no past. What would you like?" But he stopped making things up because those things weren't true either, and the telling made him feel bad. The child had his own fantasies, how things would be in the South, other children. He tried to rein in on this, but his heart wasn't in it. Whose would be? No lists of things to be done, the day providential to itself, the hour. There is no later. This is later. All things of grace and beauty, such that one holds them to one's heart, have a common provenance in pain. Their birth in grief and ashes. "So," he whispered to the sleeping boy, "I have you." He thought about the picture in the road, and he thought that he should have tried to keep her in their lives in some way, but he didn't know how. He woke coughing and walked out so as not to wake the child, following a stone wall in the dark, wrapped in his blanket, kneeling in the ashes like a penitent. He coughed till he could taste the blood, and he said her name aloud. He thought perhaps he'd said it in his sleep. When he got back, the boy was awake. "I'm sorry," he said. "It's okay. Go to sleep." "I wish I was with my mom." He didn't answer. He sat beside the small figure wrapped in the quilts and blankets. After a while, he said,
"You mean you wish that you were dead?"
"Yes."
"You mustn't say that."
"But I do."
"Don't say it. It's a bad thing to say."
"I can't help it,
I know." "But you have to."
"How do I do it?"
"I don't know." "We're survivors," he told her across the flame of the lamp.
"Survivors?" she said.
"Yes."
"What in God's name are you talking about? We're not survivors. We're the walking dead in a horror film."
"I'm begging you."
"I don't care. I don't care if you cry. It doesn't mean anything to me."
"Please,
stop it."
"I am begging you. I'll do anything."
"Such as what?" "I should have done it a long time ago. When there were 3 bullets in the gun instead of 2, I was stupid." "We've been over all of this. I didn't bring myself to this. I was brought, and now I'm done. I thought about not even telling you. That would probably have been best. You have 2 bullets. And then what? You can't protect us. You say you die for us, but what good is that? I'd take him with me if it weren't for you. You know I would. It's the right thing to do.
You're talking crazy.
No, I'm speaking the truth. Sooner or later, they will catch us, and they will kill us. They will rape me, they'll rape him. They are going to rape us and kill us and eat us, and you won't face it. You'd rather wait for it to happen, but I can't. I can't.
She sat there smoking a slender length of dried grapevine, as if it were some rare cheroot, holding it with a certain elegance, her other hand across her knees where she'd drawn them up. She watched him across the small flame.
"We used to talk about death," she said. "We don't anymore. Why is that?"
"I don't know.
It's because it's here. There's nothing left to talk about."
"I wouldn't leave you."
"I don't care. It's meaningless. You can think of me as a faithless slut, if you like. I've taken a new lover. He can give me what you can't."
"Death is not a lover."
"Oh, yes, he is."
"Please, don't do this."
"I'm sorry."
"I can't do it alone."
"Then don't. I can't help you. They say that women dream of danger to those in their care, and men of danger to themselves. But I don't dream at all." "You say you can't? Then don't do it. That's all. Because I am done with my own whorish heart, and I have been for a long time. You talk about taking a stand, but there's no stand to take. I don't care if you see that or not. My heart was ripped out of me the night he was born, so don't ask for sorrow now. There's none. Maybe you'll be good at this. I doubt it, but who knows? The one thing I can tell you is that you won't survive for yourself. I know, because I'd never have come this far. A person who had no one would be well advised to cobble together some passable ghost, breathe it into being, and coax it along with words of love. Offer it each phantom crumb and shield it from harm with your body. As for me, my only hope is for eternal nothingness, and I hope it with all my heart.
He didn't answer.
"You have no argument, because there is none."
"Will you tell him goodbye?"
"No, I will not.
Just wait till morning, please."
"I have to go."
She'd already stood up. "For the love of God, woman, what am I to tell him?"
"I can't help you."
"Where are you going to go? You can't even see."
"I don't have to."
He stood up. "I'm begging you," he said.
"No, I will not. I cannot."
She was gone, and the coldness of it was her final gift. She'd do it with a flake of obsidian. He'd taught her himself. Sharper than steel, the edge an atom thick. And she was right. There was no argument. The 100 nights they'd sat up, arguing the pros and cons of self-destruction with the earnestness of philosophers chained to a madhouse wall. In the morning, the boy said nothing at all, and when they were packed and ready to set out upon the road, he turned and looked back at their campsite, and he said,
"She's gone, isn't she?"
And he said, "Yes, she is." Always so deliberate, hardly surprised by the most outlandish advents. A creation perfectly evolved to meet its own end. They sat at the window and ate in their robes by candlelight a midnight supper and watched distant cities burn. A few nights later, she gave birth in their bed by the light of a dry cell lamp,
gloves meant for dishwashing, the improbable appearance of the small crown of the head, streaked with blood and lank black hair, the rank meconium. Her cries meant nothing to him. Beyond the window, just the gathering cold, the fires on the horizon. He held aloft the scrawny red body, so raw and naked, and cut the cord with kitchen shears, and wrapped his son in a towel.
Did you have any friends?
Yes, I did.
Lots of them?
Yes.
Do you remember them?
Yes, I remember them.
What happened to them?
They died.
All of them?
Yes, all of them.
Do you miss them?
Yes, I do.
Where are we going?
We're going south.
Okay.
They were all day on the long black road, stopping in the afternoon to eat sparingly from their meager supplies. The boy took his truck from the pack and shaped roads in the ash with a stick. The truck tooled along slowly. He made truck noises. The day seemed almost warm, and they slept in the leaves with their packs under their heads. Something woke him. He turned on his side and lay listening. He raised his head slowly, the pistol in his hand. He looked down at the boy, and when he looked back toward the road, the first of them were already coming into view.
God,
he whispered. He reached and shook the boy, keeping his eyes on the road. They came, shuffling through the ash, casting their hooded heads from side to side. Some of them wearing canister masks, one in a biohazard suit, stained and filthy, slouching along with clubs in their hands, lengths of pipe, coughing. Then he heard on the road behind them what sounded like a diesel truck.
Quick,
he whispered, quick. He shoved the pistol in his belt and grabbed the boy by the hand, and he dragged the cart through the trees and tilted it over where it wouldn't be so easily seen. The boy was frozen with fear. He pulled him to him.
It's all right, he said. We have to run. Don't look back. Come on.
He slung their knapsacks over his shoulder, and they tore through the crumbling bracken. The boy was terrified.
Run, he whispered. Run.
He looked back. The truck had rumbled into view. Men standing in the bed looking out. The boy fell, and he pulled him up.
It's all right, he said. Come on.
He could see a break through the trees that he thought was a ditch or a cut, and they came out through the weeds into an old roadway, plates of cracked macadam showing through the drifts of ash. He pulled the boy down, and they crouched under the bank, listening, gasping for breath. They could hear the diesel engine out on the road, running on God knows what. When he raised up to look back through the woods, he could just see the top of the truck moving along the road, men standing in the stake bed, some of them holding rifles. The truck passed on, and the black diesel smoke coiled through the woods. The motor sounded ropey, missing and puttering. Then it quit. He sank down and put his hand on top of his head.
God,
he said. They could hear the thing rattle and flap to a halt. Then, just the silence. He looked at the boy. He had the pistol in his hand. He couldn't even remember taking it from his belt. They could hear the men talking, hear them unlatch and raise the hood. He sat with his arm around him.
Shh,
he said.
Shh.
After a while, they heard the truck begin to roll, lumbering and creaking like a ship. They'd have no other way to start it save to push it, and they couldn't get it fast enough to start on that slope. After a few minutes, it coughed and bucked and stopped again. He raised his head to look, and coming through the weeds 20 feet away was one of their number, unbuckling his belt. They both froze. He cocked the pistol and held it on the man, and the man stood with one hand out at his side, the dirty, crumpled paint mask that he wore, sucking in and out.
Just keep coming, He looked at the road. Don't look back there. Look at me. If you call out, you're dead.
He came forward, holding his belt by one hand. The holes in it marked the progress of his emaciation, and the leather at one side had a lacquered look to it where he was used to stropping the blade of his knife. He stepped down into the road cut, and he looked at the gun, and he looked at the boy. Eyes collared in cups of grime and deeply sunk, like an animal inside a skull, looking out the eye holes. He wore a beard that had been cut off square at the bottom with shears, and he had a tattoo of a bird on his neck, done by someone with an ill-formed notion of their appearance. He was lean, wiry, rakitic, dressed in a pair of filthy blue coveralls and a black bill cap with the logo of some vanished enterprise embroidered across the front of it.
Where are you going?
I was gonna take a crap.
Where are you going with the truck?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? Take the mask off.
He pulled the mask off over his head and stood holding it.
I mean, I don't know, he said.
You don't know where you're going?
No.
What's the truck running on?
Diesel fuel.
How much do you have?
There's 3 55-gallon drums in the bed.
Do you have ammunition for those guns?
He looked back toward the road.
I told you not to look back there.
Yeah, we got ammunition.
Where'd you get it?
Found it.
That's a lie. What are you eating?
Whatever we can find.
Whatever you can find?
Yeah.
He looked at the boy.
You won't shoot, he said.
That's what you think.
You ain't got but 2 shells. Maybe just 1. And they'll hear the shot.
Yes, they will. But you won't.
How do you figure that?
Because the bullet travels faster than sound. It'll be in your brain before you can hear it. To hear it, you'll need a frontal lobe and some things with names like gyros and colliculus, and you won't have them anymore. They'll just be soup.
Are you a doctor?
I'm not anything.
We got a man hurt. It'd be worth your while.
Do I look like an imbecile to you?
I don't know what you look like.
Why are you looking at him?
I can look where I want to.
No, you can't. If you look at him again, I'll shoot you.
The boy was sitting with both hands on top of his head and looking out between his forearms.
I'll bet that boy's hungry. Why don't you all just come on to the truck? Get something to eat. Ain't no need to be such a hard ass.
You don't have anything to eat. Let's go.
Go where?
Let's go.
I ain't going nowheres.
You're not.
No, I ain't.
You think I won't kill you? But you're wrong. But what I'd rather do is take you up this road a mile or so and then turn you loose. That's all the head start we need. You won't find us. You won't even know which way we went.
You know what I think?
What do you think?
I think you're chicken shit.
He let go of the belt, and it fell in the roadway with the gear hanging from it, a canteen, an old canvas army pouch, a leather sheath for a knife. When he looked up, the road rat was holding the knife in his hand. He'd only taken 2 steps, but he was almost between him and the child.
What do you think you're going to do with that?
He didn't answer. He was a big man, but he was very quick. He dove and grabbed the boy and rolled and came up holding him against his chest with the knife at his throat. The man had already dropped to the ground, and he swung with him and leveled the pistol and fired from a 2-handed position balanced on both knees at a distance of 6 feet. The man fell back instantly and lay with blood bubbling from the hole in his forehead. The boy was lying in his lap with no expression on his face at all. He shoved the pistol in his belt and slung the knapsack over his shoulder and picked up the boy and turned him around and lifted him over his head and set him on his shoulders and set off up the old roadway at a dead run.
holding the boy's knees, the boy clutching his forehead, covered with gore and mute as a stone. They came to an old iron bridge in the woods where the vanished road had crossed an all but vanished stream. He was starting to cough, and he'd hardly breath to do it with. He dropped down out of the roadway and into the woods. He turned and stood gasping, trying to listen. He heard nothing. He staggered on another half mile or so and finally dropped to his knees and put the boy down in the ashes and leaves. He wiped the blood from the boy's face and held him.
"It's okay," he said. "It's okay."
In the long cold evening with the darkness dropping down, he heard them only once. He held the boy close. There was a cough in his throat that never left. The boy, so frail and thin through his coat, shivering like a dog. The footsteps in the leaves stopped, then they moved on. They neither spoke nor called to each other, the more sinister for that. With the final onset of dark, the iron cold locked down, and the boy by now was shuddering violently. No moon rose beyond the murk, and there was nowhere to go. They had a single blanket in the pack, and he got it out and covered the boy with it, and he unzipped his parka and held the boy against him. They lay there for a long time, but they were freezing, and finally he sat up. "We've got to move," he said. "We can't just lie here." He looked around, but there was nothing to see. He spoke into a blackness without depth or dimension. He held the boy's hand as they stumbled through the woods. The other hand he held out before him. He could see no worse with his eyes shut. The boy was wrapped in the blanket, and he told him not to drop it because they'd never find it again. He wanted to be carried, but the man told him that he had to keep moving. They stumbled and fell through the woods the night long, and long before dawn the boy fell and wouldn't get up again. He wrapped him in his own parka and wrapped him in the blanket and sat holding him, rocking back and forth, a single round left in the revolver. "You will not face the truth. You will not." In the grudging light that passed for day, he put the boy in the leaves and sat studying the woods. When it was a bit lighter, he rose and walked out and cut a perimeter about their Siwash camp, looking for sign. But other than their own faint track through the ash, he saw nothing. He went back and gathered the boy up. "We have to go," he said. The boy sat slumped, his face blank. The filth dried in his hair and his face streaked with it. "Talk to me," he said. But the boy wouldn't. They moved on east through the standing dead trees. They passed an old frame house and crossed a dirt road, a cleared plot of ground, perhaps once a truck garden, stopping from time to time to listen. The unseen sun cast no shadow. They came upon the road unexpectedly, and he stopped the boy with one hand, and they crouched in the roadside ditch like lepers and listened. No wind. Dead silence. After a while he rose and walked out into the road. He looked back at the boy. "Come on," he said. The boy came out, and the man pointed out the tracks in the ash where the truck had gone. The boy stood wrapped in the blanket, looking down at the road. He'd no way to know if they'd got the truck running again, no way to know how long they might be willing to lie in ambush. He thumbed the pack down off his shoulder and sat and opened it.
"We need to eat," he said. "Are you hungry?"
The boy shook his head.
"No, of course not."
He took out the plastic bottle of water and unscrewed the cap and held it out, and the boy came and took it and stood drinking. He lowered the bottle and got his breath, and he sat in the road and crossed his legs and drank again. Then he handed the bottle back, and the man drank and screwed the cap back on and rummaged through the pack. They ate a can of white beans, passing it between them, and he threw the empty tin into the woods. Then they set out down the road again. The truck people had camped in the road itself. They'd built a fire there, and charred billets of wood lay stuck in the melted tar, together with ash and bones. He squatted and held his hand over the tar, a faint warmth coming off of it. He stood and looked down the road. Then he took the boy with him into the woods. "I want you to wait here," he said. "I won't be far away. I'll be able to hear you if you call."
"Take me with you,"
the boy said. He looked as if he was going to cry. "No, I want you to wait here."
"Please, Papa."
"Stop it. I want you to do what I say. Take the gun."
"I don't want the gun."
"I didn't ask you if you wanted it. Take it." He walked out through the woods to where they'd left the cart. It was still lying there, but it had been plundered. The few things they hadn't taken, scattered in the leaves, some books and toys belonging to the boy, his old shoes and some pieces of clothing. He righted the cart and put the boy's things in it and wheeled it out to the road. Then he went back. There was nothing there. Dried blood, dark in the leaves. The boy's knapsack was gone. Coming back, he found the bones and the skin piled together with rocks over them. A pool of guts. He pushed at the bones with the toe of his boot. They looked to have been boiled. No pieces of clothing. Dark was coming on again, and it was already very cold. And he turned and went out to where he'd left the boy, and knelt and put his arms around him and held him. They pushed the cart through the woods as far as the old road and left it there, and headed south along the road, hurrying against the dark. The boy was stumbling, he was so tired, and the man picked him up and swung him onto his shoulders, and they went on. By the time they got to the bridge, there was scarcely light at all. He put the boy down, and they felt their way down the embankment. Under the bridge, he got out his lighter and lit it and swept the ground with the flickering light. Sand and gravel washed up from the creek. He set down the knapsack and put away the lighter and took hold of the boy by the shoulders. He could just make him out in the darkness. "I want you to wait here," he said. "I'm going for wood. We have to have a fire."
"I'm scared."
"I know. But I'm just a little ways, and I'll be able to hear you. So if you get scared, you call me, and I'll come right away."
"I'm really scared."
"The sooner I go, the sooner I'll be back, and we'll have a fire, and then you won't be scared any more. Now don't lie down. If you lie down, you'll fall asleep, and then if I call you, you won't answer, and I won't be able to find you. Do you understand?" The boy didn't answer. He was close to losing his temper with him. And then he realized that he was shaking his head in the dark.
"Okay," he said. "Okay."
He scrambled up the bank and into the woods, holding his hands out in front of him. There was wood everywhere, dead limbs and branches scattered over the ground. He shuffled along, kicking them into a pile, and when he had an armful, he stopped and gathered them up and called the boy, and the boy answered and talked him back to the bridge. They sat in the darkness while he shaved sticks into a pile with his knife and broke up the small branches with his hands. He took the lighter from his pocket and struck the wheel with his thumb. He used gasoline in the lighter, and it burned with a frail blue flame, and he bent and set the tinder alight and watched the fire climb upward through the wicker of limbs. He piled on more wood and bent and blew gently at the base of the little blaze and arranged the wood with his hands, shaping the fire just so. He made two more trips into the woods, dragging armloads of brush and limbs to the bridge and shoving them over the side. He could see the glow of the fire from some distance, but he didn't think it could be seen from the other road. Below the bridge was a dark pool of standing water among the rocks, a rim of shelving ice. He stood on the bridge and shoved the last pile of wood over, his breath white in the glow of the firelight. He sat in the sand and inventoried the contents of the knapsack. The binoculars, a half-pint bottle of gasoline, almost full, the bottle of water, a pair of pliers, two spoons. He set everything out in a row. There were 5 small tins of food, and he chose a can of sausages and 1 of corn. And he opened these with a little army can opener and set them at the edge of the fire, and they sat watching the labels char and curl. When the corn began to steam, he took the cans from the fire with the pliers, and they sat, bent over them with their spoons, eating slowly. The boy was nodding with sleep. When they'd eaten, he took the boy out on the gravel bar below the bridge, and he pushed away the thin shore ice with a stick, and they knelt there while he washed the boy's face and his hair. The water was so cold the boy was crying. They moved down the gravel to find fresh water, and he washed his hair again as well as he could, and finally stopped because the boy was moaning with the cold of it. He dried him with a blanket, kneeling there in the glow of the light, with the shadow of the bridge's understructure broken across the palisade of tree trunks beyond the creek. "This is my child," he said. "I wash a dead man's brains out of his hair. That is my job." Then he wrapped him in the blanket and carried him to the fire. The boy sat tottering. The man watched him that he not topple into the flames. He kicked holes in the sand for the boy's hips and shoulders where he'd sleep, and he sat holding him while he tousled his hair before the fire to dry it. All of this like some ancient anointing. "So be it. Evoke the forms. Where you've nothing else, construct ceremonies out of the air and breathe upon them." He woke in the night with the cold and rose and broke up more wood for the fire, the shapes of the small tree limbs burning incandescent orange in the coals. He blew the flames to life and piled on the wood and sat with his legs crossed, leaning against the stone pier of the bridge. Heavy limestone blocks laid up without mortar. Overhead, the ironwork brown with rust, the hammered rivets, the wooden sleepers and cross planks. The sand where he sat was warm to the touch, but the night beyond the fire was sharp with the cold. He got up and dragged fresh wood in under the bridge. He stood, listening. The boy didn't stir. He sat beside him and stroked his pale and tangled hair. "Golden chalice, good to house a god. Please don't tell me how the story ends." When he looked out again at the darkness beyond the bridge, it was snowing. All the wood they had to burn was small wood, and the fire was good for no more than an hour, or perhaps a bit more. He dragged the rest of the brush in under the bridge and broke it up, standing on the limbs and cracking them to length. He thought the noise would wake the boy, but it didn't. The wet wood hissed in the flames. The snow continued to fall. In the morning, they'd see if there were tracks in the road or not. This was the first human being other than the boy that he'd spoken to in more than a year. "My brother at last." The reptilian calculations in those cold and shifting eyes, the gray and rotting teeth, claggy with human flesh. "Who has made of the world a lie every word." When he woke again, the snow had stopped, and the grainy dawn was shaping out the naked woodlands beyond the bridge, the trees black against the snow. He was lying curled up with his hands between his knees, and he sat up and got the fire going, and he set a can of beets in the embers. The boy lay huddled on the ground, watching him. The new snow lay in skiffs all through the woods, along the limbs and cupped in the leaves, all of it already gray with ash. They hiked out through the woods to where they'd left the cart, and he put the knapsack in it and pushed it out to the road. No tracks. They stood listening in the utter silence. Then they set out along the road, through the gray slush, the boy by his side with his hands in his pockets. They trudged all day, the boy in silence.
By afternoon, the slush had melted off the road, and by evening, it was dry. They didn't stop. How many miles? 10, 12? They used to play quoits in the road, with four big steel washers they'd found in a hardware store, but these were gone with everything else. That night, they camped in a ravine and built a fire against a small stone bluff and ate their last tin of food. He'd put it by because it was the boy's favorite, pork and beans. They watched it bubble slowly in the coals, and he retrieved the tin with the pliers, and they ate in silence. He rinsed the empty tin with water and gave it to the child to drink, and that was that. "I should have been more careful," he said. The boy didn't answer. "You have to talk to me."
"Okay."
"You wanted to know what the bad guys looked like? Now you know. It may happen again. My job is to take care of you. I was appointed to do that by God. I will kill anyone who touches you. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
He sat there, cowled in the blanket. After a while, he looked up.
"Are we still the good guys?"
he said. "Yes, we're still the good guys."
"And we always will be?"
"Yes, we always will be."
"Okay."
In the morning, they came up out of the ravine and took to the road again. He'd carved the boy a flute from a piece of roadside cane, and he took it from his coat and gave it to him. The boy took it wordlessly. After a while, he fell back, and after a while, the man could hear him playing. A formless music for the age to come, or perhaps the last music on earth called up from out of the ashes of its ruin. The man turned and looked back at him. He was lost in concentration. The man thought he seemed some sad and solitary changeling child, announcing the arrival of a traveling spectacle in shire and village. Who doesn't know that behind him, the players have all been carried off by wolves? He sat cross-legged in the leaves at the crest of a ridge and glassed the valley below them with the binoculars. The still, poured shape of a river, the dark brick stacks of a mill, slate roofs, an old wooden water tower bound with iron straps. No smoke, no movement of life. He lowered the glasses and sat, watching.
"What do you see?" the boy said.
"Nothing." He handed the binoculars across. The boy slung the strap over his neck and put them to his eyes and adjusted the wheel. Everything about them so still.
"I see smoke," he said.
"Where?"
"Past those buildings."
"What buildings?" The boy handed the glasses back and he refocused them. "The palest wisp." "Yes," he said. "I see it."
"What should we do, Papa?"
"I think we should take a look. We just have to be careful. If it's a commune, they'll have barricades. But it may just be refugees."
"Like us?"
"Yes, like us."
"What if it's the bad guys?"
"We'll have to take a risk. We need to find something to eat." They left the cart in the woods and crossed a railroad track and came down a steep bank through dead black ivy. He carried the pistol in his hand. "Stay close," he said. He did. They moved through the streets like sappers, one block at a time. A faint smell of wood smoke on the air. They waited in a store and watched the street, but nothing moved. They went through the trash and rubble, cabinet drawers pulled out into the floor, paper and bloated cardboard boxes. They found nothing. All the stores were rifled years ago, the glass mostly gone from the windows. Inside it was all but too dark to see. They climbed the ribbed steel stairs of an escalator in a small department store, the boy holding onto his hand. A few dusty suits hanging on a rack. They looked for shoes, but there were none. They shuffled through the trash, but there was nothing there of any use to them. When they came back, he slipped the suit coats from their hangers and shook them out and folded them across his arm.
"Let's go," he said.
He thought there had to be something overlooked, but there wasn't. They kicked through the trash in the aisles of a food market. Old packaging and papers and the eternal ash. He scoured the shelves looking for vitamins. He opened the door of a walk-in cooler, but the sour, rank smell of the dead washed out of the darkness, and he quickly closed it again. They stood in the street. He looked at the gray sky, faint plume of their breath. The boy was exhausted. He took him by the hand.
"We have to look some more," he said. "We have to keep looking."
The houses at the edge of the town offered little more. They climbed the back steps into a kitchen and began to go through the cabinets. The cabinet doors all standing open, a can of baking powder. He stood there, looking at it. They went through the drawers of a sideboard in the dining room. They walked into the living room, scrolls of fallen wallpaper lying in the floor. He left the boy sitting on the stairs holding the coats while he went up. Everything smelled of damp and rot. In the first bedroom, a dried corpse with the covers about its neck, remnants of rotted hair on the pillow. He took hold of the lower hem of the blanket and towed it off the bed and shook it out and folded it under his arm. He went through the bureaus and the closets, a summer dress on a wire hanger, nothing. He went back down the stairs. It was getting dark. He took the boy by the hand, and they went out the front door to the street. At the top of the hill, he turned and studied the town, darkness coming fast, darkness and cold. He put two of the coats over the boy's shoulders, swallowing him up, park